Hello, dear heart. Welcome to the Flourishing Practitioners podcast, where we talk all things about space holding, caring for our clients, and succeeding in our businesses. We explore the wisdom from coaches, counselors, and healers. My name's Gabrielle Walker, and I'm so honored that you're here. Let's dive in. This week's podcast is with Alison Braithwaite, who is the author of, in her own words, Women's Wisdom to Move You from Surviving to Thriving. What we talk about actually is her PhD research, and this interview was actually in 2021. I haven't released it yet. It's just taken me this long to edit it. And Alison has recently submitted her thesis, and she's waiting for her defense. So she's right at the end of the journey now, but this particular interview was right at the beginning of her journey. So it may be interesting for her to hear this back. At the time, it had also been discovered that in one of the Indigenous schools or First Nations schools in Canada, that there were all these bodies buried. And we talk about this a little bit at the end, but the majority of this talk is around the difference between different types of people and approaches, collective and individual, our ways that we fit into the corporate space. And I'm really drawn towards this topic because I know it's a lot of the things that people like us deal with, people who we're trying to work out how to combine the holistic and also being in corporate spaces where sometimes we have to change our body or our energy or our ways of being to fit or to function. Sometimes we don't, sometimes we do a little bit, and it's all a navigation of working out how to provide for ourselves and how to provide for others and to share our gifts and be authentic. And part of that can be a big challenge sometimes. So Alison provides her perspective. There are also a few different trainings coming up if you feel the call. The May the 8th, we're starting Raranga Maiorangi, so our second weaving in the heavens. Then on we have an Aroha Day, so a day where members of the community can come on 11th of May and receive, and that is in Bibra Lake in WA. The next training we're running is a mini training, so I have soft, loving hands of connection training in Borlu in Perth on the 22nd and 23rd of June, and I'll leave it at that for now. There's a few other things coming up, and I will link the events page if you're interested in any of those. Yet, I hope you enjoy this podcast.
Yeah, Alison Braithwaite is a beautiful woman from Canada, and we met, I don't even know how long ago, maybe 8-7 years?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a long time ago.
It's just been a beautiful weaving since that time. At the moment, she's doing her PhD and looking into workplace empowerment and traumatization, what draws me so much to what you grapple with. We look at a corporation as an isolated entity, but it's not. Like, people aren't just resources, and people aren't, you know, they've got hearts and souls and bodies and minds. Yet we talk about it like this contained story with a mission and a vision and a strategy. And then we ask people to be that.
A lot of people are kind of rake apart because of working in a corporation. And I was one of them, totally unraveled as a result, burnout, incredible burnout. And so my PhD is kind of my pilgrimage to discover where I'm going and who I am, and going back to that place of, yeah, this is who I am. And slowing down and feeling things and getting back into my body. And I think we're so in our heads, and we are so running, and we got to do this and we got to do that. And like, there's some big prize at the end. When I left the corporate world, I spent time with people, and I'd say, here's a triangle and here's a circle. And we have to move from this triangle world to the circular world. And the triangular world is hierarchical, and it is, climbing to get to the top. And everybody wants to be at the top. The top can only take 1%. So we're all wanting to get to scarcity. And if you look at a triangle, it's very solid base. It's immobile. It's really immobile. And you have, you know, the 3 points, like people going off in different directions. And there's tension there, like real tension. And then it's like a spearhead. So it's a symbol of violence. And the circle is, for me, it's like when you sit in a circle, it's a different feeling. It is, you can see everybody's face. Everybody has a voice. And everybody's sharing their story. And then each story, like the story evolves as it goes around the circle. And it's get listening, like truly deeply listening to each person who's speaking. And in that listening, a different story comes out and a story of understanding. It's so much deeper. I put in the workplace, I put people into circles many times. And I remember the first time I did it in a boardroom, I got the tables out of the boardroom and we sat up at this huge circle and I watched people come to the door and they would come through the door like they're going into this regular boardroom and they would stop at the door when they noticed it was a bunch of chairs in a circle. And then they would go, oh, and they'd find their seat. And it can make people really uncomfortable because you don't have anything in front of you. Like you're not hiding behind the table. There's no protection and no separation from everybody else. It just acknowledges that we're all interconnected and we all have a voice and we all have value. And of course, a circle is so able to like turn quickly and move. It's mobile and the triangle is just a triangle and it's solid and hard to move. So in my research with like, I've interviewed like I think 26 people from various different corporations, and some actually because they put the corporate world, so some people that worked in government felt that was the corporate world, and some people interviewed moved into the not-for-profit and as they moved on to their business, so they were, some went through many different organizations before they started their business. And what they talked about, and they didn't talk directly about it, but what I'm seeing from their words is these two power structures. And the one is the triangle, and it's kind of the power over. The circle is power with. And power with people sometimes don't even understand that there is this dominant power over. And they don't understand.
Which I'm really interested in as well is around that, how power over people. Like power with people just cannot grasp power over or vice versa.
Yeah, and I think that power over people see power with people as a threat. Like they're used in the corporation. There's one guy who I interviewed, he was on all sorts of committees, like the social committee and the giving committee, and he was made his way up and he was really conscious of always looking after the people that were below him. And if people emailed him, he would email them right back. And as he was moving up the organization, he actually had somebody tell him, it would be easier for you if you didn't care so much. And then he got to the point, and he's very outgoing, and he would like to hum and whistle or sing or whatever as he walked down the hall in the workplace. And he was told, don't do that. At this level, you should not be doing that. And at this level, you shouldn't be on those committees. And at this level, so he started to get these rules about being at this level. But he was so connected into the organization because he had, because he cared about people. So people knew who he was and likely shared things with him. So he had his fingers on the pulse of the organization. And he also saw things that would make more sense to be done differently. So he would go to the senior executives that were responsible and he would fight for the things and say, you know, you should be doing this and you should be doing that. So he was up to become a director in the organization, so one below the VPs. And he really thought he was going to get the job. And like he really felt that he was going into the senior executive's office to hear that he got his directorship. And the guy he was meeting with said, you know, I really thought I was going to give you this directorship, but I can't because there's two senior executives who think you're confrontational and who think you're not a team player, even though he's been proven he's a team player for the years that he's been there. And I think so often power with people see things differently. They see that there's better ways of doing things that look after people as well as the organization. And it looks beyond the bottom line and cares for the organization and the people within the organization. So often the power over people, they know how to play the game because they've moved up to the very top. And many are threatened, I think, by power with. One woman that I interviewed talked about having somebody above her say, "You have so much power in this organization." And she was just like, "What? Like, who says that? Like, who actually says that kind of thing?" And she'd never thought about it. And she says, "I had influence." And she had influence because she cared.
Do you think that the power over people feel comfortable in that archetype? Is that naturally who they are? Or in the power within that's naturally who they are? Or do you think it's a learned behavior? Or,
well, I think it's very valuable. And really, these two power structures are worldviews, right? Or habitats, or mental models, or whatever language you want to use to define them. So, and our worldviews are based on our value system. So it's like a clash of values. When you know the rules of how to get to the top, which are the dominant rules of society, that you can get there in quite an easeful way. Like you've never come across the same barriers that some people face when they don't, if they're the only in the room. And I was the only woman in the room for most of my career. And it is a difficult place to be because you don't, like, I did not understand the rules of the game. I didn't understand their interactions at all. And I would see tension and conflict and emotion like sitting under the surface. And they, "Oh, no, that's," I would call them on things and would be personally attacked when I was making a very, or not heard. Like I said over and over again, "You're not listening to me. You're not listening to me." But I think they've never really been taught what listening means. And really they thought it was just keep your mouth closed till she's done. And then we can talk about what we want to talk about. And we don't really have to respond to what she said in any way. But we stayed quiet. So therefore we must be listening. For me, it seemed to be gendered to me because I was the only woman in the room. And yet when I've interviewed people, they talk about how bad women bosses are and how women don't support each other. And the boss that was, or the person, the executive that was telling that guy not to sing in the hallway or not to, that was a woman. Not to be himself is basically it.
That was something I did want to clarify earlier, that it isn't a man or woman thing. Or
yes.
Masculine. Yeah. And I've been trying to find new words to discuss that and integrate that for me as well around the masculine and feminine, or patriarchal and non-patriarchal, because it is, I feel, unraveling a little bit as well. I feel like that's what this time has been doing, is just unraveling some of those dichotomies.
I think in order to survive in a capitalist system, you have to take on the capitalist values. And the capitalist values are masculine values, like the archetypical masculine values of individual and independence and aggressiveness and fighting to get to where you want to go. And that becomes the way of getting to the top. So it's almost like there is this another type of glass ceiling, which is the ceiling of power. So power over, and it's difficult for power with to move up past that ceiling. And I'm just starting into my data. So I'm throwing out these things that are just totally. I'm seeing.
I forget the exact word, but those sort of objective skill sets. And then there's like these subjective skill sets, which maybe the power with people have more access to. So they have that access to like the feeling and the emotions and the community, but they can also learn the objective skill sets. And then there's these objective skill sets that are the ones most discussed in corporate spaces and the world. The aspect of that those ephemeral skills, the just the knowing of who we are sort of at our core, cannot be seen by the power with, but it also there's a sense of like seeing it with a power-based mindset rather than that's they just know who they are. They know how to interact.
Yes.
They know how to be.
Yes.
And this skill set, from what I've seen through the coaching and stuff, is that people don't realize they have that. And until they know they have that, they can't own it and use it well. But that because they view this as power. So everyone has this definition of power. But people don't realize this is actually power, and they don't realize what they have. And once they realize, they can use it for a whole different thing.
Oh, I think so. Because I remember sitting in a meeting, and it was coming up with I forget what it was called, but it was a legacy statement with the executive team. And all these words were being thrown out. And I started to listen. And I could hear the same words like this so often being said. So I wrote down the words that were being said so often. And then I just blurted that out. And I remember my boss after the fact, he said, "Alison, did you have that before the meeting?" Because he couldn't hear that. He couldn't hear what I was hearing. There's some people with a depth of listening, and maybe it's not even listening, it's a depth of being able to receive what's happening in a room. And sometimes that can be really uncomfortable, because what's happening in that room is very uncomfortable. And you're able to feel the tension that's happening between people. And if you call it out, you become the source of the tension, because you've actually called it out. And to have honest conversations, I think, is very difficult, and it makes people uncomfortable. I think definitely there is a skill set that you, like, I had no idea I had, and I didn't get why nobody else could hear what I was hearing. It was so obvious. They said the same words, and it just blew my mind that he asked me, had I decided that's what it was going to be before I even sat down at the table? No, I had no idea what was happening. And partly I wonder if it's like, okay, here are the old souls that have lifetimes of experience of reading rooms and people and spaces. And then there's others that don't. But I also think some people are unfortunately grow up without a connection to their body and without a connection to their emotion. In the past, it was definitely, you know, boys, don't cry and suck it up and off you go. Whereas as girls, little girls are able to cry. And so boys lose their connection to their emotions, and girls later on lose their connection to voice. And that is, I forget her first name, but Gilligan, a feminist psychologist, I think she is. Totally forget the name of the book. But it does, it talks about the difference of how it throughout, like, we get separated first. We've been separated from the land. Not many of us are actually get our hands dirty growing things, more and more now, especially through COVID. I think that people started doing that because they had nothing else to do. So we're separated from the land, and then and went into industry and became workers rather than, you know, subsistence farming. So all of a sudden you're separated to become a worker, and then you're separated from yourself in the work, because the work isn't what your gift to the world is. The work is what is going to give you some money so that you can buy the food that you would have grown if you could subsistence farm in the commons. And then you get separated from other people, totally other separations. And we get separated from our own history, and we get separated in so many ways. So we don't have a connection to self, and therefore we don't have connection to others, and we do not have connection into land. And all are really important to actually know yourself. And since I started researching for my PhD, like doing my own research, I have been walking the same area in our neighborhood. And lucky we have little pockets of quite magical nature. And there's a little wetland that almost daily I walk to. And I'm seeing like the changes that happen in that little patch of pond, and notice birds and notice frogs and turtles and all sorts of things that others run through that area and don't see. When you can spend time in a little patch of earth or water and start to notice the transitions that are happening in that place, it connects you to something deeper. And that connection to something deeper then allows you to start getting that connection back to in you. This is what I see and notice. Like I got an email from the wife of a guy that I knew in university who died of brain cancer many years ago. And she out of the blue emailed me, I came across your letter, and she had looked at my website and she took out little pieces of my website and reflected them back to me. So things that I had written, wow, this is amazing what you do. And it's like, I wrote that. That is what I do, you know? And I know that I see people. I see beyond what they are. I see beyond what they are doing at this moment. And I think we all have that in us. And that is part of community, is to have people go, oh, I see you. And then when I see you and tell you what I see of you, and then you tell me what you see in me, like we are just creating, co-creating your beautiful word, co-creating this beautiful elevation of each other, because we just keep supporting each other, moving into our next phase and our next phase and our next phase. And that is what the world's supposed to be. And that is not what the workplace is. The workplace can really just be dragging you down, unless you're willing to play the game to get to the top of the pyramid. And I think when you're at the top of the pyramid and you've got there in that way, there is an insecurity there, because you know how you got there, and you know that somebody else can come along and take your place, because they might outshine you in playing the game.
True, even in that co-creation aspect, because I feel, you know, like sometimes I'll feel just the energies of people who are thinking pyramid about this or whatever, and it's like, I know I did it by co-creation, like in circle, like I know that these synchronicities or random, just so much randomness that supported me along the way, and I am so blessed and so privileged, but at the same time, mm-hmm. I know that what's meant to be mine will be mine. And so there's an aspect of just nourishing the capacity to receive rather than nourishing and seeking what I feel should be. I wouldn't have been able to do that without this pilgrimage and without the journey.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. It used to drive me crazy when I heard this. Oh, just it's abundance. Like it's abundance. It's just there. And I really, like, I do see what happens with scarcity and what happens in the corporate world is you get funneled into this very tunnel vision. And it's like, this place that I'm in is so important. And the stuff that has to be done is so important. And really not. What we don't teach children is to understand their own value and to understand what really matters to them. And what makes them angry? Because what makes us angry is a beautiful key to what we value. Anger has such a bad rap in our society. Like, you're not supposed to be angry, even if you've been yelling for centuries that, you know, wake up and listen to me. It's like, why are you so angry? Like, if you would just be more calm, I would listen to you. But I was actually told by one of my bosses after quietly going into his office and saying, okay, this is what I'm going to say in a meeting. And I said it in the meeting, and then he was really angry with me. Why didn't you tell me? And I said, I did. I came into your office. Don't you remember yesterday I came into your office and I said this?
Oh, yeah.
Well, next time, can you yell and swear at me? It's like, you need that to hear me? It's like, why? Why can't you just hear what I'm saying?
I've been working with that anger aspect a bit in myself because it was an emotion that I detached from quite young because I freaked myself out a few times. Like I broke my mum's window and I nearly killed my sister. And like I literally had her and I knew in the moment that I could kill her. And I was quite young, at 8 or something, or maybe a bit older. But I was like, oh, that scared me so much that I just turned it off at that age. Oh. So I've been sort of feeling into, because anger arises in me, you know, and I've just been feeling into that and realizing that same thing, like this thing that I assumed was bad is actually what's needed for the moment sometimes, you know, because it's not a thing expressing all the time, but the times when it has arisen and I'm like feeling like, oh my God, I was angry, but it's actually the thing that the moment needed at times, but it's not an emotion that I'm comfortable with having. At all.
We tend not to dive into what is actually going on. And I was, by the end of my time in the corporate world, I was so angry because over and over again, my values were being trod upon. I joined a company that I thought had similar values to me, but the people that were in the powerful positions didn't seem to be following those values. So it was like I tried to get them to follow their own values and it made me very angry. And it made me actually hate myself that I was so angry, which is not a good place to be. So I left that place hating myself. And it took me a long time to really dive into the anger. And some of it is ancient anger. Like as a woman, all that has happened to women in the past too, like there's a lot to be angry about. And that sits with us as well as our own personal anger. And sometimes anger has to be expressed to, you know, change the energy in the room and say, wake up, you know, wake up and listen to what's going on here. And so often I think like our dominant society says anger is bad. You should be happy all the time. Like just be happy and have really positive energy and the energy that you put out is so important. And I think it takes us out of authenticity if we are performing happiness all the time. And really emotions are like this. Like we cannot be up here all the time. Your emotions don't match the room. It can be an issue. So if the room is angry, then you walk in and there's anger in the room. So how do you dissipate that, or how do you actually have a conversation about, yeah, I'm feeling anger in the room? And most people in the corporate world go, whoa, what are you talking about? We're just sitting here having our coffee waiting for the meeting to start. So we're not good at having difficult conversations, and we're not especially good at talking about emotions, especially in the workplace.
And it's so interesting because I identify more as a power with person, but I also think I've had a level of observational, you know, I didn't buy into the system ever, even though I got caught in it often. So I would often have an aspect of more observational, like, what's that about? And what's that about? What the, you know, so that was more my mindset from school, because even in school I was like, this is a whole lot of crap, like the teacher's saying that and that's not, then they're doing that or they're saying that, but I can see in my world that that's not true, you know. I knew that from young, but I just didn't know what to do about it. I didn't know what other system existed. So I think in some ways we're actually it is a threat and it is also that aspect of influence. It's like once that person realizes that they are influential, it's not even that they're a threat to the organization. They're a threat further than that, because they won't offer their resources and gifts to the organization either, because they realize that they have worth and capacity well beyond that.
That's so interesting, because I did offer my gifts big time. Mm. Like I offered my entire belief system to the to the corporation, and it totally shifted the way of thinking. But it also, like, I lost myself to it. They now had me, and I didn't.
I guess what I witness in a lot of clients and people grappling with that, so many people like, I don't know what to do. I know I don't want to be here, but I don't know what where to go. Like, here isn't aligned, but there's this other where. How is there, like, in your own personal experience or readings or understandings, is there a way we can be here while we look for there, or be not lose our whole self without giving our whole self over?
The people that were able to continue in the workplace and work on where they're going were not completely depleted. And it is the ones who just kept, and the ones who kept pushing up and pushing up against what was happening until they just got to the point that I can't stay here anymore. And for me, I just blurted, I cannot be here anymore. And I was really saying, I cannot be here. I want to be, I've got to get out of here and discover how to be again. But the ones, there were a lot who found a guide. Like, I feel like it's a pilgrimage. I feel like when you're realizing this is not the place for me, and for me, I should have left a lot sooner. But then I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if I'd left sooner, and became totally depleted. To the point that when I tried to push myself out into society again, it was like, no, I can't. I just either get triggered with anger or burst into tears. So there was no way to go. It was like, I have to just be here. And that was a hard thing to do, is just to, okay, what do I really need? And I kept trying to put myself out there. You're supposed to, look, all these people have businesses. They're all offering themselves. And anytime I tried to offer myself, it was like, oh, like emotionally, I don't have the capacity. I don't have the reserves to do this. So if you are somebody who still has reserves, I think it's possible to work and do your pilgrimage at the same time. And it really is a spiritual journey. And it's a journey where I think you have to drop your entire status. Like, it is exactly like a pilgrimage. Like, you're meeting people who you don't know their status, they don't know your status, and really your status is meaningless. Like, it was a title. But there's a huge identity crisis that you go through. Like, who am I? I remember when I quit, the next day I was going to a community meeting, and I'd always introduced myself in any meeting that I had gone to, Allison Braithwaite, with the company that I worked with, and here's my title. And I remember, what am I going to say in this community meeting when I'm just Allison Braithwaite? And what does that mean? What I have, you know, what power do I have as just Allison Braithwaite? It, like, there was just so many things to grapple with. During that time, I was also writing a book. So I was pushing myself to write this book. And I was interviewing the most wonderful women who really also gave me guidance as to how to deal with what I was dealing with. Except at the time, And that was the purpose, actually, because I started the book before I left the organization, and I was hoping it would help me to figure out my next step in the company I was going. But this is a great company. It's a wonderful company. It does wonderful things. If I can't work here, where am I going to work? We have so many myths that keep us attached. And there's so many people who just, and it's a privileged position to be in, to be able to just say, I'm out of here. I cannot be here anymore. And I don't know what my next step is, but I am going to, you know, leave and figure it out. A lot of people don't have that.
Yeah. And it's also such a contradiction as well, because some people have it, but don't realize they do. As in, because of the narrative of this, you know, this is what you need and this is what you need to own and this is what you need to keep up and this is, you know, all, none of that's been broken down yet either. And they actually have the resources, but that the thought of not having whatever, all that story, we'll call it a story for lack of, it's not a story, it's also reality. It is literally like, and I, when you were talking, I was like, that's totally the journey I went through, was forced to go through as well in many ways. Like I wasn't struggling at work that I knew, like I was, because I didn't fit, but just life circumstances that have some really big sort of things changing and shifting in my world all at once that forced me to stop. And then in the stopping, I found I didn't have the resources to be able to continue. So prior to that, I had the resources. After those life events that pretty much grounded me, I couldn't. And so it was like, what the hell? And it's been 7 years since that, you know, 7 or 8 years since that time of getting to a place where I see it also differently. And I think that's the thing that in some of these discussions that isn't told, like it takes that long to see things.
It does. Yeah.
Like, or longer, but it is a long, it's a gradual pilgrimage. It's not a pilgrimage that you can take in a week and go, okay, well now I know that I'll go here and so then everything will be better.
Yeah. And it's so interesting because for some people it isn't. I was the only woman in the room for 30 years of a career, and that's a long time. And all of that kind of took away at me to the point where I said to my boss, I can't be here anymore. And it was very much value-based, like something happened that my integrity is at stake here and I cannot stay here if I'm going to stay integrated at all. And yet totally unwound, I guess. A piece by piece are coming back to myself. And this PhD is part of my journey, because I remember getting, I just got out of the blue an email that said, hey, the University of Waterloo has these fully funded PhD positions, here's who you contact if you're interested. And I thought, oh, okay. And I'm Skyping with my two advisors within 2 days, and I had my application in to the university probably 2 days after that. But everything else before that was a struggle. Like to create my website was a struggle. It took forever. And to write that email, yeah, with an email that came to me that I still don't understand how it got to me. I just happened to be on a mailing list and I got it. It is like those moments that you know, hey, this is what I'm supposed to do. Yeah. And my first semester was very hard because academia is exactly like the corporate world. It is push, 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 read this, read that. And we're going to completely restructure your brain. Like I just could feel the neural pathways in my brain changing.
Because I really relate. Me, my master's was exactly what you're describing. I mean, I'd already started it before I had this sort of breakdown, but it was literally a container for me to have some aspect of title without knowing what I was doing. And so my ego was sort of like, okay, here you are, you're a master's student. You know, like that's the thing you can put forth in the world. While you're actually completely rebuilding yourself, your integrity, your spirituality, your sense of being, trying to follow the pings and the ways of the world, but also nourishing your mind, because for me I am a real, you know, ideas and concepts and things nourish me. I'm not a person who wants to be floating around. I don't, you know, like I love that I get to have that aspect in my life, that I get a lot of, I get a lot of space in my life now. But it was through the studying and the being a high degree student that allowed me to figure out how my productivity actually works, not within a 9-to-5 structure, but where I actually function best, when I actually am the most productive, when I can achieve the most. And then that's given me, so I didn't know that at the time because I felt very trapped by the academic mindset and their narratives and what they believe you're doing and why, what they believe your values and purpose are in choosing to do a thesis. I felt like I actually feel like my whole time was a big bit of a fight, but it was a good fight because I was also fighting internally with those aspects of myself within myself.
Yeah, so funny because, you know, I am older and I have no interest in becoming an academic, none whatsoever. And I remember, because I felt like I was being pushed and pushed and pushed, and I just told my advisors, I said, I don't want to talk to you. You need to be on my own what it is I want to do. And so I restructured my research question, and then everything started to flow. I'm getting the vocabulary that I can use to understand what I went through in the corporate world and how to move from that place of feeling totally broken and not myself to this very integrated human being, which is never lost. It's always there. It just requires the right people around you and the right environment. And we need other people to support us in big ways.
I might be getting a bit spiritual with it, but in terms of the trauma that's like patterning our world, do you feel like one of the ways that at least in businesses and corporate space, that we cope with that is just contain it? Like this is the pathways we're traveling here. Nothing else can come in.
You can't look at the trauma of that can happen in a corporation separate from going back to when capitalism started, and it started at the time of the witch hunts and the next thing, like the slave trade, and then contact at so many different continents, and this needing to go out and explore and claim places as if they were empty spaces. And okay, now we own this. Now it's ours, and oh, those people that are here, we'll just push them aside so that we can have this and we can own this. And I just feel like, you know, the stories that I'm hearing from people, there's ripple effects from that time, like forward. And how can a corporation, a capitalist tool that was built on all that history, not still carry the violence of that history and still be about more and owning and creating more and exploiting other people and exploiting resources? And some people get a bigger piece of the pie and it's like, I'm going to hoard this. So aspects of sharing and interconnection and interdependence is lost when you are in that constant, I've got to perform, I've got to get this done. And it's almost like our drive is hijacked by the company. So we have a certain personal drive that would align with our personal values. And when we have an environment that is aligned with who we are, then who we are can just express more and become more. And but when you're in a workplace, the workplace has a goal and the workplace has its values that here's what we say we do, but it's not necessarily what we do. And what a lot of people who leave, it's because of a conflict in their personal values and the corporate values. So it's almost like they disintegrate because they're integrity is at stake if they were to stay. And they use such vivid language. Like one woman said, if I had gone through that door, I would just burst into flames. I would self-combust. And it's just, I think about that. And the visual is going back to witch hunts where people were burned at the stake. And it's like we're carrying forward all this history and history so present in our world today and is shouting at us to pay attention and notice how entangled we all are, how interconnected, how interdependent we are. And what better way to bring it to our attention than a virus? It shows how connected we are to every part of this world. Not all of us, but the dominant society, really, we're kind of pushed along, like get on the treadmill, run the race, keep running, keep going, keep going, keep going, keep going. And to actually pause is not something that happens very much pre-COVID.
And I sense through my work that's often that same push and pull you were talking about in the corporate spaces of, we have this thing of like, okay, you can just be yourself. You can be your integral self. You can be your authentic self. You know, from 5 when you knock off till 7 when you start in the morning, or you start getting ready for work in the morning, you can be authentic. But go to work, put on a mask, be someone else. And it's not always that, because there's aspects of us that's fulfilled by those things as well, but it's still a narrowing.
And we're also told that we're responsible for our own emotions. And I think, yes, we are, but that is also another way of marginalizing people. So if you cannot control your own emotions because of trauma, you're almost shunned. Oh, look, you know, what's going on? You look at what we learn in the workplace, emotional intelligence. Emotional intelligence, to me, it is a way for people who have no sense of their own body to say, I'm emotionally intelligent because I don't get angry. But people who get angry is because they're not being heard. And they've said the same thing over and over again, and they're not being heard. And so it starts becoming anger. And instead of saying, okay, maybe this is the meeting of two different worldviews. And honestly, there's so much trauma happening in the world right now. And instead of going, hey, look at that, what's going on? Like, what's going on for you? When we are able to deal with our own trauma, we open space to be able to go, oh, what's happening here? Like, what's happening with this person? And how do we actually get curious about that? Perhaps we can hold space for that person to deal with their trauma. And you see it playing out, like you see it playing out on social media and things. Like, people are so polarized in so many aspects. And it's like everybody's trauma is just bubbling up and bubbling up and bubbling up. And I think, I mean, it does require the individual to say, hey, but we're all, when you see people getting so upset so easily, there's more going on. And yet we can't seem to be able to hold space for that.
I do want to talk a little bit about what's happening in Canada at the moment with the, we would say here Indigenous peoples, but they say First Nation in Canada. So how that's sitting with the country and how you see that in terms of some of the trauma, and even, you know, we can take this back to the witch hunts, which was in Europe, but there's also that aspect of like the beginnings or the seeds of Canada and everything that's being brought up from the ground at the moment.
There's a lot going on. It's like an awakening, I think. And it's like, it's a light, a rising up of these incredible voices of the original people of this land. And it's almost like the children that were stolen from their parents and went to residential school, who in these residential schools, the purpose of them were to take the Indian out of the child and therefore get rid of the Indian problem in this country. Because at the time of pre-Confederation or Confederation, our leaders at the time saw the original people of this land as a problem, because the land itself was to be owned by the people, the settlers who came. What's being discovered should not be a surprise to people. Truth and Reconciliation Commission years ago, all like survivors of residential schools went and they provided statements about what their experiences were. They have said for years that children died in these schools and they were buried. And yeah, so there's a huge reconciliation and I really happening. And so there's the people that have been motivated to really learn and learn a lot about our past and our history and the myths that Canada has been built on. You know, Canada as the peacemaker and Canada as the country that likes to say I'm sorry all the time, and of a country that is gentle and friendly. And our myths have been spun in so many ways, like beer companies and telephone companies and donut companies all weave this myth as well in their advertising and sell this myth. And yet we're learning, or so many are learning right now, that it is a myth, and that perhaps this isn't the truth of who we are. And we're being asked to really look at ourselves. And I think many are, and many are still hanging on to the myth. And when that's what you've learned in school, you know, your entire schooling has been that myth and that history that has been written to ensure that we feel attached to the country of Canada, without understanding that this land means something completely, completely different to the original people of this land. And it's not just a piece of land. I read Robin Wall Kimmerer's book, and for the life of me at the moment, I can't remember it. Such a beautiful book. It shows how traditional knowledge and science working together can just answer so many questions. But she talks about language, and she talks about, you can see why we are so different. Like, our language is very noun-based, English language, and the Anishinaabe language has more verbs, and that we only give personhood to people and sometimes probably some animals that are close to us. For them, the only time they use it is for man-made things. Like, a table might be an it, but a tree is not. So there's a totally different relationship that is built with their language, and that we don't have in English. So if language, and that's why I think it's just so important to care for these languages, all the languages of the world, because these are world perspectives that we can be losing, and we need those perspectives now. Like, we really need a different perspective. You know, the earth is telling us, hey, it's time to pay attention and time to notice that we have to do things differently.
My sense when I read about those children being dug up was just like, because in our practice it's very ancestral, and the work that we do healing a lot of trauma is asking for those things to be resolved. So we're asking through people's bodies that things that are unresolved through past ancestral generations get resolved. So when that happened for me, there was just a sense of like, oh, how beautiful the Aboriginal peoples of the land, or the Indigenous peoples of the land, have done a lot of healing, and the grandmothers are now have created that space for that to happen. It's a different perspective in a way sometimes, and it can be really, I love what you're saying about the stories, because stories can be so empowering, and they can be, and we can find our strength and our mana and our dignity in those moments, but they can also have, everything has the two sides, depending on where you're looking from and what emotional or spiritual state you're in at that time. That a thing has a different meaning. And if we become stagnated in that meaning, we're losing the whole picture of what's possible.
That recognizes that we're in a constant state of co-creation. And we can choose how to co-create, and not let the past create for us. And our attachment to our myths, I mean, from a dominant society in this country, our country is built on so many myths. And I think people are just waking up to it, but also people are hanging on to it. So our identities are entangled in, they are a truth for someone, but, you know, history is always told from the perspective of the, theoretically, the winner, I guess, or the oppressor, or however you view it.
And it's so interesting that you
talked about, you know, trauma in the body, and that your work is about bringing attention to the body and here are these children that looking to go home, really. Mm. And it's like, this is in some ways, and I'm talking from a very white centered place, I think, but it is, to a certain extent, it's like, hey, here we are. And I've seen that kind of thing on Facebook. It's like, hey, we're ready to go home. So they haven't, these graves have not been dug up. They use ground penetrating radar. So they're all, and it's really up to the communities. And right now I understand they're just kind of doing the healing that they need and the ceremony that they need and the discussions that they need to move forward and decide what to do. I just feel like we're being asked to pay attention and to pay attention to all the things that require healing in this world. I think Earth is trying to get us to pay attention too. Like the Earth itself is saying, hey, wake up to what's happening. And there's the whole co-creation that you always talk about. And I love that. And our sense of power is entangled in so much. And to separate and to let go of these stories that we have been told over and over again. You know, I did my master's in leadership and they talk about the importance of stories in the corporation or in the workplace. It's really important to tell your stories so you can build these stories that teach people how to be in that company. And some of those are myths as well. Like some of them are not true. Yeah, there's always more than one story happening at the same time.
Just interested in that sort of how it all plays out in the business spaces for the individual.
A couple of points that I just felt like I am fully here, fully myself, and I'm fully being myself. But it also means I'm fully giving myself away, the commodity that is helping this company to make money. It, I think, put me in a very vulnerable position.
That reminds me of one of the things you said earlier about how our ability to control our emotions is used against us. So it's internalized. So you haven't managed to do that. You, and that's out of control. And then it's internalized and we take that on. It's like, oh, I'm bad at doing this. So I feel this. Do you want to speak about that? I'm really interested in that I feel that a lot in the personal development space as well. There's a lot of, so it's almost like the stages. So initially it is an aspect of like, you do have to take responsibility for the life you've created in a way, not saying it's your fault, but there's choices we've made within there that have led us to where we are. So there's an aspect of that. But if that total, I'm responsible for everything continues on and on and on, there's an internalization that can become not healthy or used against you in some ways. So it's sort of that it's like a constant dance in and out, just strengthening the pillar of who we are. With that emotional aspect, I feel there's sometimes that thing of like, oh, if you're not happy or if you're not in the right vibe for me or if you're saying the wrong thing, you're not okay. It's not okay mm-hmm. that you're doing that right now. And I'm probably really guilty of this at times, as well. But yeah, what?
Language above emotions can marginalize people, and it tends to marginalize the marginalized already who have, like, if you have somebody who has on a day-to-day basis is facing racism, they're going to be angry, and they have every right to be angry. And if they come into the room angry and the people in that room don't take the time to say, whoa, what's going on for you today? Nobody asked me about my anger. No, probably because they were afraid to. But generally, they were afraid to because they've not been taught to have those conversations. And nobody said, hey, Alison, you're not yourself. What's going on in these very traumatic times? We have to be able to really notice people and their anger. When we're meeting somebody, we're not just meeting them in that moment. We're meeting everything that they've ever experienced, everything their ancestors have ever experienced, as well as what happened to them this morning. And all of that is coming into the room. And we do not recognize the complexity of what it means to encounter somebody, especially like a stranger. That might seem like that's an odd thing to be doing. And I've done it. I've burst into tears. I burst into tears in a store because I felt I wasn't being listened to.
I have to ask for cheese and she didn't hear me and I just started crying. I was like, no, you couldn't hear me. She's like, do you want a hug?
Because I was taking my computer in and it needed, there's something wrong with the cord. And the guy brought one out and stuck it in the computer. And he says, well, it's not the power cord. It's your computer. And so I took my computer and I walked it over to the same version that was sitting on, you know, on display. And I plugged in the right power cord. And I said, no, see, it's charging. And then I just, the fact that I had to do that, luckily there was this lovely young man who said, I can help you. And he just, like, the fact that I was crying my eyes out just had no effect on him. And he was so, so lovely. And it's, we need more of those lovely people. And I hope that I can be one of those lovely people at some point. Yeah, we don't give people the benefit of the doubt. We cannot change the polarization of the world until we can sit with somebody who is angry or seeming to have a breakdown, go, what's going on for you? And that be the standard thing in society, which means we have to slow down and we have to be able to say, I will take time with you at this moment. Although we also have to be very cognizant of our own energy, because if we're doing that every day with strangers, think, in the workplace, noticing coworkers, but when you're running so fast and you're doing, and there's another deadline, and another thing that has to get out, it's hard to have that bigger view. And I think if we did have that bigger view, it would be a much better place to work for everybody.
I feel like each other. You are already that person in the doing to uncover all this and to uncover your own journey to offer to us is so valuable and so inspiring to me.
Oh, thank you. It's been so fun talking to you.
Before we close off, is there anything that you would want to voice that you feel you haven't had the opportunity to?
I think we can be overwhelmed with everything that's happening in the world and then go, I don't know where my place is, and it's like, or how can I make a difference? And it's like, what is the tiny little thing that you can do to move yourself forward in some way and just choose one thing and move forward. Because it takes all of us just to choose that one thing that leads us to the next and the next in order to make these huge movements that are necessary.
I usually ask person in the Kōrero Miramiri to say a prayer or a thoughts out to everyone at the end, if that's okay with you. You can think of anything to offer to those who'll be joining us.
A little bit of silence and breath. It's really... the core to our lives is our breath, and just, you know, taking one deep conscious breath is the ultimate prayer. And maybe consciously taking it in as in, when you're breathing in, you're borrowing from the earth, and when you're breathing out, you're giving back. And just in that breath, you have that reciprocity with the rest of the world. I love you.
That was beautiful.